case of a customs union, the member states that belong to a customs union agree to use the same import duties. So if a T-shirt is coming from China, for example, whether it's going to Botswana or Namibia or South Africa, the import duty would be the same. And at the moment, that import duty is 45%. So on the port coming in Walvis Bay into Namibia, for example, the import duty that would be levied there is 45%. That's the same duty that would be levied at the port of Durban when a T-shirt comes from China into South Africa. So one of the defining features of a customs union is that the member states of the customs union agree when they're dealing with imports coming from outside the customs union to charge the same tariff structure. So the same import duty on T-shirts, the same import duty on wheat coming in, or the same import duty on shoes. So the tariff book, which includes the list of all products, and they have different codes that are used by the customs authorities, will be the same for the five member countries. So in fact, when we talk about the tariff book that we use in South Africa, that is actually the SAKU tariff book, because Namibia, Botswana, Lesotho, and Swaziland use the same book of tariffs. And the important other feature of the customs union, and I think this is very important, the second part of your question, when the member states form a customs union, there are no duties on trade between the member states. So goods can move from South Africa to Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, or Swaziland, and there are no duties charged at the borders. So we have liberalized trade among our member states. And that's an extremely important part of the regional integration agenda that we have in SAKU, but also in the case of, for example, the Southern African Development Community, where those 15 member states have established a free trade area. So they have agreed to liberalize trade amongst themselves so that we reduce the duties until they are zero, so that we don't charge any import duties as a good goes, for example, from South Africa to Zambia, another member of the free trade area in SADC. I think perhaps just to take a look at these background features of the customs union. By definition, the customs union then is a group of member states that have no import duties amongst themselves, and they have the same import duties on products coming from other countries into the customs union member states. So effectively, a customs union means we have a single customs territory. So as a product goes from South Africa to Botswana, Lesotho, or one of the other member states, no import duties are charged. And I think that's an extremely important point to keep in mind. Now, this definition means that when it comes to making trade policy and trade policy discussions, the member states of a customs union have the same trade policy. And this is why there is a lot of emphasis when we're talking about negotiations, whether it be with the European Union on the EPA negotiations, economic partnership negotiations, or negotiations with India or with the Mercosur group of countries. The SAKU members must negotiate with one voice because they have a single trade policy. And this is very important. So an individual member state of a customs union cannot unilaterally just say, well, we need more revenue, so let's increase the import duties on products because we would like to raise more revenue through this source of taxation. Determination of the common external tariff is a customs union-wide activity. And this is extremely important. So it means effectively that the member states of a customs union give up trade policy space. They cannot simply go and negotiate agreements with third parties without the consent of the other member states and without working together in those negotiations with other member states. And I think this is extremely important. Now, by contrast, a free trade area, which has been established in the Southern African Development Community, that's the 15 states in Southern Africa, including countries like Zambia, Zimbabwe, Malawi, Madagascar, Seychelles, and Tanzania's included, Angola, DRC. Those are all members of the Southern African Development Community, SADC. They have established a free trade area. Now, the difference between a customs union and a free trade area is extremely important, because in a free trade area, the member states reduce tariffs to one another. So we would like to liberalize trade amongst ourselves to increase intra-regional trade. But in a free trade area, each member state maintains its trade policy space to have its own tariffs to third parties. So, for example, the import duties for Zambia for products coming from China would be very different to, for example, what the neighboring Malawi charges on those imports coming from China. They retain trade policy space towards third parties. So those are two extremely important defining features. Now, within a customs union, a very important feature, and sometimes a very contentious feature of the customs union, is how do we share the customs revenue, that common revenue? How do we share that? And if we just think in terms of the import duties being collected at the various border posts coming into SACU countries, that all goes into the common revenue pool. And we need some formula, the basis on which we're going to share that customs revenue. And of course, in the context of SACU at the moment, there is a lot of focus on the revenue sharing arrangement. We know, and I'll talk about this in a bit more detail a little bit later, we know that some of the smaller countries like Lesotho, Swaziland, and Botswana to some extent depend very heavily for their government budget on the revenue that they receive from the SACU revenue pool. In fact, in the case of Lesotho, more than 60% of their government revenue some years comes from this single source, which makes them very vulnerable to any changes in the revenue sharing formula, and therefore poses a lot of challenges at national level in terms of how they manage their fiscal policy, their government budget, and look for alternative sources of government revenue. Now, in the case of SACU, what we are seeing is that this century-old customs union is really undergoing a process of renewal, looking towards the agreement which currently governs the customs union arrangement, which is the agreement concluded by the member states in 2002. And what we've seen during the last year, in 2010, are some very significant developments, which will mean that SACU going forward could be very different from the SACU as we've known it in the past. So what we've seen at the centenary celebrations in April 2010 is that a new vision and mission were unveiled. And the vision is as follows, is for SACU to be an economic community with equitable and sustainable development, dedicated to the welfare of its people for a common future. Now, it's important to note there a focus on sustainable development and also equity. And for the smaller member states, the equity will mean that we have to look at the revenue sharing formula. They will be concerned that equity means how much revenue are we getting from the common revenue pool. The objectives that were identified at the centenary celebrations, the mission, in other words, identifies a whole range of issues, some of which we find in the 2002 SACU agreement, but some go beyond what is articulated in that 2002 agreement. And if we just focus on some of those objectives, first one, to serve as an engine for regional integration and development, industrial and economic diversification, the expansion of intra-regional trade and investment, and global competitiveness. Now, this is very important because on the one hand, there's a strong focus on enhancing regional integration. But the final point also means that one of the objectives of SAACU articulated last year relates to our role in the global economy, looking at global competitiveness. And of course, that links very strongly to industrial and economic diversification. Now, we have to keep in mind that when we take a look at the customs union member states, South Africa constitutes the largest component of that regional economy. We're looking at about 90 to 95% of the regional economy is actually South Africa. The South African economy is diversified in terms, for example, its industrial base, having a range of industries. The smaller countries, by contrast, have much more limited diversification. So they are dependent on a smaller number of industries. And in the case of Botswana, for example, of course, the mining industry, the diamond mining industry, is really the mainstay of the economy. So we're dealing with significant asymmetry within the context of the SAACU member states. And this, of course, brings a lot of interesting challenges in terms of developing a common vision and a common mission for SAACU. Other objectives that are articulated, and I think these are very important as well, to build economic policy coherence. Now, this takes us back to a very important part of the 2002 SAACU agreement, which requires that the member states develop common policies in a number of key areas, and one of those is industrial policy. Now, at this stage, South Africa has an industrial strategy, an industrial policy action plan, but by contrast, the smaller countries don't have such developed policies. They have certain incentives that they may offer investors who come to invest in the countries, but a coherent industrial strategy does not exist in the smaller countries. So, again, this poses challenges for South Africa in terms of assisting those smaller countries in the context of SAACU in terms of developing policy coherence and harmonization and convergence to meet the development objectives of the region. Third objective, to promote sustainable economic growth and development for employment creation and poverty reduction. I think the focus on employment creation, which we in South Africa are very familiar with, this is a primary policy objective that cuts across our economic policies. Job creation is extremely important for us. In the same way, employment creation is also a very important objective for the smaller countries. Poverty reduction, very important challenge for all of us. And this is quite an important issue for us to keep in mind, because, of course, if we take a look at South Africa, our high income inequality, poverty, certainly a very, very significant challenge. In the same way, our smaller countries are also facing challenges related to poverty reduction and hopefully elimination. And of course, job creation would be a very important vehicle for addressing poverty and development issues. Another very important objective that our heads of state and government articulated last year is that SAACU should serve as a building block for ever closer community of peoples in Southern Africa. Now, this broadens the scope for us to look in terms of regional economic integration at Southern Africa. And of course, here we are focusing not only on SAACU, but also the Southern African Development Community, SADC. And it's important to keep in mind that all of our SAACU member states also belong to SADC. So there is a lot of discussion around the possibility of SALCU being the core of the deeper integration agenda of Southern Africa, with perhaps other member states joining SALCU. Certainly there has been some discussion, for example, related to Mozambique, whether Mozambique would consider joining SALCU. So this, I think, is extremely important, because a little bit later we'll take a look at some developments in the broader Southern African and Eastern African region that have implications for SALCU and also, of course, for South Africa. Another very important objective relates to common policy development. And as I mentioned earlier on, common policy development is a strong feature of the 2002 SALCU agreement. And we see here our heads of state and government emphasize common policies and strategies in areas like trade facilitation. And this relates, for example, to what happens at our border posts, how we manage our border posts. Now, we have noted, of course, that there are no import duties as a product goes from South Africa to Lesotho. But nonetheless, there are border controls. So even within the customs union, there are border controls and measures that happen as a product goes from one member state to another. And those are important, for example, in terms of health and safety regulation. And we've seen recently, when we take a look at the agricultural sector, and particularly livestock, foot and mouth disease breaking out in a particular area, the border controls are very important to manage those kind of challenges. Competition policy, strong emphasis for us to cooperate as member states of SALCU in the implementation of competition policy. Now, at this stage, only South Africa has a functioning competition authority with a law and a policy that is implemented by that competition authority, our Competition Commission, the Tribunal, and the Competition Appeal Court. Namibia has recently established its Competition Commission, and it has started hearing some cases, but it's still in the early phases of that implementation. The other countries are working in this area, but again, it's a lot of work that still remains to be done. The final objective that our heads of state and government articulated on the occasion of the centenary was to develop effective, transparent, and democratic institutions and processes. Now, this is particularly important in terms of the institutions that are provided for in the 2002 agreement, some of which have been established, but some have not been established. So there is work to be done in this area of institutional development for the management of SALCU affairs. I think a very important development, we've been referring to these objectives and the vision articulated by the heads of state and government. And a very important aspect of SALCU, dimension of SALCU, is that there is no summit of the heads of state and government yet. By contrast, for example, SADC has a summit where the heads of state and government meet. So it's at the highest political level that decisions can be made. That is not in existence yet for SALCU. However, during two occasions last year, the heads of state and government of SALCU member states did meet as ad hoc meetings of those heads of state and government. And a resolution was passed at council, which is the highest decision-making body of SALCU at this stage, for the institutionalization of a permanent summit. So this is a very important step in the institutional development of SALCU that took place last year. Now, our SALCU member states have moved fairly quickly in this regard, and a draft annex to the SALCU agreement has been prepared to establish a permanent summit, but this has not been established as yet. I think just very quickly to go back to the 2002 SALCU agreement. because this is the legal instrument, the legal framework, which governs how, as member states, South Africa, Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland, manage their affairs as a customs union. Now, the SALCO agreement provides for various institutions to be established, and the ones that I've listed here are extremely important. First of all, a secretariat, which really manages the day-to-day affairs of the customs union. Now, the secretariat was established in July 2004, when the SALCO agreement entered into force. And that secretariat is based in Windhoek in Namibia. The 2002 agreement also provides for a number of other institutions, some of which exist, but some of which have not been established. It provides for a SALCO tariff board. Now, the SALCO tariff board would be the regional institution, the SALCO institution, where member states discuss the common external tariff and any changes or applications to that tariff. So, for example, if the clothing industry in South Africa would like to see that import duty on certain items of clothing increased, the process would be as follows. That industry producing an application would go to the national body, the SALCO national body. Now, this would be an institution based in South Africa, and in fact, our national body exists already. That is ITAC. So the industry would go to ITAC with the application. It would be considered by ITAC. ITAC would make a recommendation, which would then go to the SALCO tariff board, where the other member states would have an input via their national bodies, their respective national bodies. Now, the other member states don't have national bodies yet. So this is a challenge. So currently, still, ITAC serves as the SALCO tariff board. So this is extremely important. Our national body still performs the function of the SALCO tariff board. So if a South African industry would like some tariff amendment, it makes an application to ITAC, and part of the ITAC process requires consultation with the other member states. So input from the clothing industry in Lesotho, Namibia, Swaziland, and Botswana would form part of the process of assessing that application, and a recommendation would then be made. And of course, ultimately, that decision has to be made at the SALCO level, at the council level. So this would be very important for the other member states to establish their national bodies, and for SALCO, the tariff board, to be established. There is also a SALCO commission. Now, this already exists, and this is a technical committee consisting of senior government officials. So a lot of technical issues, trade policy issues, other issues are considered by the commission. Technical liaison committees exist also in areas like agriculture, so where sector-specific issues are considered. And the Council of Ministers, as I've mentioned, this is the highest decision-making body of SALCO. So decisions are taken at that level. There may be input from the commission, recommendations, technical reports, but decisions are taken at the SALCO Council of Ministers. Another very important focus in the 2002 SALCO agreement relates, as I've mentioned, to common policy development. This is part 8 of the agreement. It requires that our member states develop common policies in the areas of industrial policy, agricultural policy, competition policy, and unfair trade practices. Now, the status of common policy development is quite varied amongst those different areas. On competition policy and unfair trade practices, experts at UNCTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, have assisted to develop annexes, but these have not been adopted or implemented. on agricultural policy. Some studies were conducted last year, but again, we don't have a common agricultural policy yet. On industrial policy, this, given the diversity among the member states of SAKU, is of course quite a challenging area. Now, South Africa's Department of Trade and Industry late last year took the initiative to develop a concept note on what could a SAKU industrial policy look like. And this is a very interesting and a very important document because it takes a look at the areas of competence and competitiveness of the different member states and articulates perhaps an approach which could be used by the SAKU member states to develop a common industrial policy. So this, I think, is an important area to take a look at. Given that the Southern African Customs Union is a customs and an excise union, of course, revenue sharing is a central point. Now, some analysts might almost cynically say, this is the glue that holds SAKU together. This is why the smaller states are here. They depend so much on that revenue. And, of course, the revenue sharing formula then often becomes a contentious issue. And there are a number of reasons why it becomes contentious, in addition to the revenue dependence of the smaller countries on SAKU revenue. And one example of challenges that take place in the discussions about revenue sharing is that a very important part of the revenue sharing formula requires that the member states record their trade with other SAKU members. So intra-SAKU trade becomes a very important part of the formula for determining the share of the revenue pool that the member states get. And every November at the council meeting, the member states come with their trade data to say, this is how much we've imported from other SAKU member states. And I think what is important here is, of course, that as far as the small member states are concerned, most of their imports come from South Africa. So South Africa really is the important trade hub for SAKU. It exports a very significant number of goods and services, of course, to the other SAKU member states. So this is a very important issue. Now, there has been a lot of discussion about revenue sharing in recent years and discussion around perhaps amending that formula. Sorry, I missed your hand there.
Preferably, Honourable Smuts, if you didn't mind, unless you didn't hear something. You see, I can't hear you.
I just wanted to check who is monitoring. Is it this council? And who is monitoring this intra-trade between countries on an ongoing basis? Between country A and country B and so on.
Yeah. Yes. Perhaps just to respond to this, because this is extremely important in the formula currently, is that each member state would, at its border post, collect data on the imports coming into that country. So, for example, Lesotho at the border post would be collecting customs forms which record all the imports going into Lesotho. And our customs officers at that border post would be required to record where the products are coming from. Are they coming from South Africa, or are they coming from China, India, Brazil, or the European Union? So this has to be recorded by each of the member states. There are some challenges that one can foresee in the collection of that data that relate, for example, to the fact that a country like Lesotho is landlocked. So, of course, all of the imports going into Lesotho are coming through, it would be, South Africa. The only other country that has an external border is, of course, Namibia. It has a port, but most of the imports that are going to Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland actually come through South Africa. And this means that the imports are recorded first at at Durban, Oliver Tambo, or Cape Town, so the points of entry into South Africa. And at that point of entry, a record would be made of, are those products destined for Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, or Swaziland? Are they going in bond? Or are they perhaps, and I think this is where some challenges definitely do occur, are they coming to South African retailers who are also operating in the neighboring countries? Excuse me, so the products may be being imported by ShopRite or Pick n Pay or Truworths or one of the South African retailers. They then become part of the distribution hub of that retailer and are then sent to their final destination. So one can see that there are some challenges in the recording of the data. And certainly the November meeting of council, we understand, is always a big challenge because the trade figures do not add up. The trade figures do not add up. So the recording of imports and their final destination is sometimes a challenge when we take a look at the intra-SACU trade. So I think these are issues which have also been taken into account. I'll say a little bit more about the revenue sharing formula. There has been a study by international consultants from Australia to look at the current revenue sharing formula and to make some suggestions and recommendations about reform of that revenue sharing formula. Now, this study is not yet finalized. The final version is not available yet in the public domain. However, the council meeting scheduled for April this year will be discussing the final report and the recommendations and may make a decision on amendments to that formula. So this is very much currently on the agenda of all the SACU member states. I think the final point on the slide that I would like to just refer to, and I think this is a very useful document, I have provided a short summary of that with the resources for the workshop, but the full report is available on the World Trade Organization website, and this is the WTO, the World Trade Organization Trade Policy Review. All the 153 member states of the WTO, their trade policies are reviewed regularly. Now, the regularity of that review depends on how large that country is in terms of its participation in world trade. So the European Union, the United States, they are reviewed every 2 years. But smaller countries are reviewed every 4 years or every 6 years. Now, our most recent SACU trade policy review was November 2009. Now, it's very important to note that each of the SACU member states is in their own right a member of the WTO. So South Africa is a member of the WTO, Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland are also members of the WTO. But the trade policy review by the World Trade Organization is a SACU trade policy review, and that is for the reason that we are a customs union. We have the same trade policy. We have the same tariffs. So there's no reason to review the trade policy of South Africa independently from Botswana or one of the other countries because, of course, we are a customs union, and that is extremely important. Now, this review is a very comprehensive review that takes place, and all aspects of trade policy management, the implementation of the SACU agreement are all reviewed in the context of that trade policy review. So this is for as resources, a very important resource for us to consult. What I'd like to do now very briefly is to take a look at just some of the issues that are currently on the agenda of SACU. So I've called it just a status review, some of the issues we have discussed already, so I'll go through those quite quickly. I've mentioned legal and institutional development. If we take a look at the implementation of the SACU agreement of 2002, then there is work in progress. There is work to be done still there. And we've referred to that already. As far as common policy development is concerned, again, these issues we've mentioned. I have noted here the developments on industrial policy. So we are required to develop common policies on industrial development, and our Department of Trade and Industry has developed this concept note, which member states may have had access to already. The review of the revenue sharing formula, as I've mentioned, this is current, very, very current. A draft report has been prepared, and I have made that available to the committee, but it may be an idea to wait for the final report, which we understand has already been submitted to the SACU Secretariat, but is not available in the public domain yet. But as soon as it is, and we have a copy, we will certainly pass that along as well. I've also mentioned the final point on this slide, and that is following the two meetings of the heads of state and government in 2010, a decision was made to institutionalize the summit. Now, this is a very, very significant development, and we'll certainly, I think, see progress as far as that's concerned in this year. I would like just to spend a couple of minutes. I see my colleague, Professor Colin McCarthy, has arrived, and I'm eating into his time now, to mention a few issues which have been raised in connection with the revenue sharing formula and the review of that revenue sharing formula. We've noted the first point, which relates to particular challenges that we find in the context of a discussion about the revenue sharing formula. The dependence of the smaller member states on this source of revenue, and I think this is extremely important. Some analysts would say that, of course, their public sectors have grown significantly as a result of their dependence on this revenue. And of course, in recent years, until the financial crisis, this common revenue pool did grow beyond our expectations. But also, these countries face challenges, their narrow tax bases in terms of alternative sources of government revenue, their options are distinctly limited. Another very important issue about the customs component of the revenue pool is, of course, as trade liberalization takes place, import duties, tariffs are reduced, and therefore the longer term predictions are that the customs pool is going to shrink. So this, I think, is important to keep in mind in terms of our trade liberalization agenda as a customs union, in terms of negotiations with other partners, India and others that we are negotiating with. I think there's also been discussion on import duty exemptions. These are used very much by South African industry as a result of the narrow industrial basis of the smaller countries. It really is something which has a very important South African dimension. So, as I mentioned there, as soon as the final report is available, that will be made available to members to consider. Just broad outlines in terms of the recommendations that are coming from that review of the revenue sharing formula. According to the study that has been conducted, interviews with member states have indicated that there are two specific demands that they would like as member states for the revenue sharing arrangement, the revenue sharing formula to address. And the first is compensation. And the compensation would be articulated in the sense of the adverse effects of SACU membership. As we've noted, when a country is part of a customs union, it gives up trade policy space. It does not have an independent tariff policy, if you like. And this is very important. There is, of course, an ongoing discussion on the polarization that exists within SACU, where we have an agglomeration of industry in the large member state in South Africa. Investments are drawn to existing industrial development, the infrastructure, and a number of other features of the South African economy attract investment far more than would be the other member states. Trade diversion, this would mean that countries, smaller states, would be importing from South Africa rather than from a third party. And in some cases, it can be argued that the common external tariff has a price-raising effect, which would mean that under other circumstances, if a country did not belong to SALCO, it might have a lower tariff, for example, on motor vehicles, because there's no domestic industry to protect. Whereas currently, if we take a look at the SALCO tariff book and the import duties on motor vehicles, that reflects the industrial policy priorities of South Africa. We would like to protect the domestic industry, whereas a small country like Lesotho has no domestic automotive industry to protect. So its tariff, by choice, would arguably be much lower. So that's the first component, the first demand, if one formulates it that way, that the member states articulated in the context of the study. The second one is development, a strong focus on development. And this brings us back to some of the key objectives of SALCO as a vehicle for regional integration, for sustainable development, development convergence, strategy, policy coherence. So focusing here on longer-term development issues, arguably in the context of a regional integration agenda. Based on these two demands, the study has argued, and it is likely that this is to be found in the final report as well, that one can actually take a look at compartmentalizing the contributions that come into the common revenue pool into two components, each one tagged, if you will, to the two demands, respectively. So import duties, the study argues, one can tag very closely to compensation. Excise duties to the development component. Excise duties or perhaps a different source of revenue. So if excise duties were not to be included in the common revenue pool, members could be asked to make a contribution based on their gross domestic product, so on their GDP, for example. There are different possibilities there. But as I say, this is very much part of an ongoing study. The final report will certainly look at these issues in more detail. In the final minute or so, what I would like to do is just for us to keep in mind that, of course, a very important aspect of the mission and the vision of SALCO is also to take a look at SALCO member states in the global economy, really to take a look at us within the broader global context. So the relationship between SALCO, customs union, those member states, and other partners in the global economy. Of course, as we've mentioned, all SALCO member states are also members of SADC, the Southern African Development Community. Now, SADC has established, it launched a free trade area in August 2008, but there are still some challenges. This free trade area is still work in progress. And we've seen recently, for example, that three countries, Tanzania, Malawi, and Zimbabwe, have applied for derogations on their tariff reduction, saying, we simply cannot reduce our tariffs in accordance with the commitments that we made because we need that revenue. So this is an important challenge to keep in mind. The establishment of a free trade area has implications for the member states because tariff reduction will affect receipts that go into the government coffers. And I think that's extremely important to keep in mind for us. Some members of SADC would like to move ahead to establish a customs union. Now, this is quite a big step to take if we think about our discussion of SALCO and the kind of issues that are on the agenda here. And with 15 member states, of course, the challenges could be magnified even further than they are in the context of SALCO. Other member states of SADC don't want to establish a customs union. They would be happy to consolidate the free trade area. So some discussions taking place in that context. Another very important development on the African, the intra-African agenda, was a decision in October 2008 by 26 member states belonging to SADC, Southern African Development Community, the East African Community, and the Common Market for East and Southern Africa, COMESA. They agreed in Kampala, Uganda, to establish a tripartite free trade area. Now, this would be an enormous regional trading bloc, stretching literally from Cape to Cairo. Now, a lot of technical work has been done by task teams, and technical analysis has been done already. And in fact, there is a draft agreement and 14 annexes for this tripartite free trade area. But no negotiations among member states have taken place yet. So there is a summit that will be held, summit of those member states, the heads of state and government of those member states, the 26 member states. We understand it was supposed to take place in March, but March is fast running out, so it might be in April. And according to our Minister of Trade and Industry recently, he indicated that perhaps by mid-year these negotiations would begin. Now, there are a number of very important issues that we need to be monitoring in terms of preparations for those negotiations. We understand that issues such as rules of origin. So those rules which determine the economic nationality of a product, is it a South African product or is it a Zambian product, could be a very technical and challenging area of the negotiation. Because, of course, the nationality of the product will determine whether that particular product gets the benefits of that free trade area or not. So I think this is a space to watch very carefully. We'll see what happens at the summit and when the negotiations are going to start. And then, of course, from South Africa's perspective, we have a strong focus on the development of South-South partnerships, of relationships with other developing countries. The negotiations between SACU and India are ongoing. In the context of those negotiations, members would know that the ambition from the SACU, particularly South Africa's side here, is to negotiate a preferential trade agreement. So we limit the number of products for which we will reduce the tariffs. India's ambition, we understood, was much higher. They wanted to include issues like trade and services on that agenda as well, but that has not happened. Of course, SACU and Mercosur have concluded a preferential trade agreement. And then, of course, there's a question about China. South Africa and China signed a memorandum of understanding in September last year with our state visit. And I think this is an extremely interesting memorandum of understanding. It includes cooperation and the intention to cooperate in a number of services areas like energy, transport, communications, and so on. But what we should note is, of course, that the status of a memorandum of understanding, this is not, our legal colleagues tell us, enjoying the same status as an international agreement. So a memorandum of understanding is not a legal instrument that can be enforced, that we can say, but China, you promised that you would help us. We can legally enforce what is in the memorandum of understanding. But it's a statement of intent, of goodwill, and the intention to cooperate. And then, of course, in December, we heard the announcement that South Africa has been accepted as part of this group of countries known as the BRICS. So Brazil, Russia, India, and China, South Africa has now joined, and Professor McCarthy will say more about that. Economic partnership agreements with the European Union, we have no agreement yet. Those negotiations are still continuing. There are still some issues that need to be finalized there. But then, of course, the trade agenda and approaches from potential partners continues. And we understand that countries like Japan, Malaysia, Indonesia, South Korea have approached South Africa and in some cases SACU through the SACU Secretariat to discuss the possibility of starting negotiations with the group of SACU countries. And I think I'm going to stop there. I think the conclusion just relates to some of the issues that have been raised already. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hartzenberg. We really appreciate it. Thank you. And I think for those of us who may have thought we knew something about this, we all learned something extra this time. Thank you very much indeed. Members, I see that our next speaker is here, but we also do want to make some space for any, perhaps we can say questions, we can have a broader discussion later. So are there any questions that you, clarifications that you may urgently require, please? I only see two hands up. Are there any others? Right. So here, let's start with yourself, Honourable Salah, Honourable Mabasa, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable September, and I'm not all that familiar with the names here, but is that... I don't have the name here, unfortunately. Could you just give us your name, sir?
Let's move on.
Order, and I would like you just to keep it brief without a preface.
Thanks, Chairperson. My question would relate to the role of parliaments, the different parliaments of these different countries in SACU, in the development of these policies. Secondly, whether the documents referred to in your slides are accessible. I would also want to go back to the question earlier raised by Honorable Smart Ngwenyama to look at the issue of the monitoring formula that we might perhaps, if time allows, have to reflect on it. But linked to how far we can reflect is also dependent on whether we do have a role to play as parliaments. Thanks.
I think that we can just rapidly move on to each speaker. Thank you, Honourable Mabasa.
Mine is if we consider the rest of the world, can we say we have sisters or brothers of the SACU and the Customs Union such that we can draw comparative experiences and also to contrast this with the developments with the European Union? Thanks, Colleague.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question will be the issue of what can the members of the union do if the other members undermine the very coherence of the customs union, in particular in relation with the interim partnership agreement between the other countries and the EU.
Thank you.
Next speaker, please. Question.
Thank you.
Honourable September was... after that, please. Thank you.
Is it me then? Oh, okay.
Your surname is not September. My name. Thank you.
September.
I could change my name.
He's disputing my surname.
No. Let's not waste time. Honourable September, please.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, my question relates to the following. You know, SACU is as old as the ANC. It's 100 years old. And so it's quite interesting to find out if one evaluates its 100 years, I mean, what would be the important issues to extract from that 100 years, the The second one is, how are we going to reach consensus on the following areas? Well, obviously on the relationship between trade and revenue, that problem that remains. And then also there seems to be a bit of difficulty amongst the SACU countries on South Africa's own industrial policy. To what extent and what are the main features of the difficulties that they are raising in this regard? Thank you, Chair.
Right. And then we have our next question from the Honourable Mbubu. Is that right?
No, it's not.
Well, could you give it to me?
Mbubu, it's M-U-B-U.
So it's just Mbubu.
Mbubu,
thank
that's
you.
Right. Yes.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It means so, yes. I just wanted to find out, I noticed that in the overall agreement within SACU, there's also the element of exchange rates, that our currency and the Namibian is almost the same, except for Botswana. But why is that so? Is that part of the SACU agreement? Second, in the way of how the revenue that's generated from this port, common port, is there regulations on how that money is going to be spent by the recipients? Because there's a tendency that we have heard of some countries spending these monies on luxury cars for, I don't want to mention the name, for their wives and stuff like that. But also, does this also extend to the political environment, lack of democracy in some of the members, human rights abuses? Is that outside of this? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Nganyama.
My question is the adverse effects of the review, and that has happened, especially with regard to smaller countries, Swaziland, Lesotho, recently, and how this is really impacting on those countries currently, and whether with the revenue sharing formula that has been reviewed, is there hope that there will be cohesion and not the polarization that you've referred to, and especially because you've also referred to the decline, long-term decline in customs revenue, and the sustainability of this and the union within that context, especially if we take into consideration the point that you've raised about the revenue sharing formula. The last one is...
Honourable Nganyama, we can't give that length of time to anyone, I'm sorry. Honourable Kotsi.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, when you look at SACU, as old as it is, there is also a body, SADC, which is also a Southern African development body. I would have hoped that by now, SACU is actually has been integrated into the region, because on a number of issues that we speak about, the forum of the ministers, the decision making at SADC levels, those areas are actually working well and may even working stronger. Is this body not the body that even us as South Africa should encourage that it becomes part of SADC? Because then there is more power, because even these smaller countries, Lesotho and Swaziland, participate in SADC. And I thought perhaps in terms of the power that is needed, it can actually be stronger at SADC level rather than at SACU level. Thank you.
Right, members, thank you very much. Ms. Hartzenberg, if you would conclude your response, broadly speaking, in 8 minutes.
Thanks very much, Chair.
I'll try to do that. And if there are some questions I don't have time for, I can actually ask Professor Colin McCarthy. In fact, I know that he will be touching on some of the issues that have been raised. I think the first question with respect to the role of Parliament is extremely important. What practically happens when we take a look at, for example, SALCU matters and international trade agreements is sometimes in some countries that Parliament comes into the process when an international agreement needs to be ratified. Now, that is far too late in that trade policy chain or trade policy making process. If one takes a look at a trade policy making process, then it really, as far as trade negotiations with third parties are concerned, needs to start with a strategy. Who do we negotiate with and why? What would we want to get out of a free trade agreement, for example, with another country? And it's at this stage that discussions within Parliament are extremely important. So there's a lot of preparatory work that needs to be done before an international agreement, the negotiation process starts. And I think this part of the discussion that we're having today is an extremely important contribution to broadening the discussion at the parliamentary level as far as trade policy priorities, issues, and challenges are concerned. Of course, legally, in terms of the institutional requirements and the role of Parliament, it is extremely important in that implementation process where the agreements have to be ratified, they have to enter into force before, of course, the benefits can be realized that are potential within the context of any international agreement. So I think this is an extremely important discussion. In the cases of some regional groupings, there are also parliamentary forums. For example, the SADC Parliamentary Forum is based in Namibia, and there are regular meetings that take place at that level. In the case of SACU, as I understand, there are some informal linkages among the parliaments that exist, but definitely the SADC Parliamentary Forum is a well-established institutional forum at the parliamentary level. So I think that is extremely important. I think questions related to other customs unions. Customs unions are quite rare internationally. There are not many, many customs unions. There are many, many more free trade areas because a customs union requires giving up trade policy space. So a move from a free trade area to a customs union is a very significant step for many countries, particularly if one takes a look at a group of countries where the countries are very diverse in terms of industrial structure, in terms of development, levels of development, and so on, economic size. Because the compromise in terms of the trade policy space that the countries give up can have significant implications. So it's not a decision that should be considered lightly. And I think this is extremely important. The usual examples, I think the Honourable Member indicated, we often look to the European Union. In recent years, there has been some focus taking a look at what's happening in Mercosur. They have faced very similar challenges in some cases to the ones that we faced in SACU. There are also a number of other customs unions on the African continent, but they are work in progress. There is still a lot of work that needs to be done to fully implement those customs unions. So in terms of comparative experience, I think another very important issue is that SACU has a very specific and a unique history and experience. It's not possible to replicate the experience of SACU. Given its long history, it comes from a very, very, very different political, economic, and broader development history than customs unions elsewhere in the world. So comparative experience, there are some lessons that one can learn from others, but given the unique nature of the Southern African Customs Union, there are some lessons perhaps that we need to learn for ourselves in the context of the Southern African region. I think the reference to coherence of the customs union, technically when we take a look at the members of the customs union, when they take a look at negotiating partnerships, free trade area with a third party, There's a lot of preparatory work that needs to be done about and before those negotiations are entered into. So the members of the customs union need to determine their common position. So when they go to negotiate with a third party, we don't have a situation where the different countries have different negotiating agendas. And I think this is perhaps something where SACU needs to look very carefully at the establishment of the common negotiating mechanism, which is provided for in the SACU agreement, which does not exist yet. So in preparations for negotiations, there's a lot of work and a lot of intra-SACU negotiations that have to take place so that they have a common position. But that is still very much work in process among the SACU member states. We hear a lot of challenges in terms of capacity that the member states articulate in this regard. We don't have capacity to prepare for the negotiations, to do the technical work, and so on. But those can be remedied in various ways. But the establishment of the common negotiating mechanism is certainly an important step in that direction. Issues about South Africa's industrial policy, I think this is a discussion which Professor Colin McCarthy will contribute to in much more detail than I can at this stage. Of course, the links between trade and industrial policy are extremely important. One could view the import tariff as an instrument of industrial policy. The tariff can be used to protect particular industries selectively. So that nexus between trade and industrial policy is a very important one. And the smaller states may argue that the SACU tariff reflects South Africa's industrial policy priorities and not theirs. So this is an ongoing discussion, but Professor McCarthy is an expert in this area, so I would leave that to him. Some question about exchange rates. Now, what we didn't mention in the context of SACU here is another regional integration initiative, and perhaps one of the success stories of regional integration in Africa, in my view, and that is the common monetary area. Now, the countries, the member states of SACU, excluding Botswana, belong to the common monetary area. And this is extremely important. It means effectively that the South African rand is legal tender in those countries. A lot of very important benefits from the private sector have been noted. For example, we had a workshop similar to this in Namibia, and some private sector representatives said, you know how important it is for us to be able to benefit from the common monetary area to the extent that we have no exchange rate risk. So if we want to order inputs for our businesses from South Africa, we have on our doorstep businesses from whom we can order. There's no exchange rate risk involved for us. So the benefits of the common monetary area in that context, certainly from the private sector, one hears about in discussions like that. But again, Professor McCarthy can say more about that. I think just in the last few seconds, as far as revenue is concerned, we have mentioned, and I think this is very well known, that the smaller countries, some of them, are very, very dependent on the SACU revenue pool. I think there was a question about conditionalities related to the revenue received from the SACU revenue pool, and of course there aren't conditionalities. So at this stage, the transfers go to the smaller countries, the payments from the revenue pool, but there are no conditionalities in terms of what they can spend that revenue on. And this has been quite a contentious discussion in the context of the revenue sharing arrangement relating to some of the issues that the Honourable Member mentioned. The final question on SACU and SADC. Of course, all SACU members are also members of SADC. So some analysts would argue that SACU can be seen as the core of SADC. And perhaps one approach to deepening regional integration, enhancing regional integration in the Southern African region, would be to take a look at SACU as that core, and other member states from SACU can consider acceding to SACU. SACU The SACU Agreement of 2002 provides for accession. It provides for new members joining. But there's a lot of discussion perhaps around on what terms and conditions accession could take place. And here there are some interesting lessons from the European Union. If one takes a look, for example, at the Eurozone countries, and so on. So there are some interesting issues, and I think the Honourable Member's questions related to the broader regional integration agenda, SACU, SADC, and even the tripartite FTA, these are extremely important for us to consider right now. I think I'll stop there, Chair. Thank you.
Really, thank you very much, Ms. Trudy Hartzenberg, who, as I'm sure members are aware now, this is not our first interaction. She is the Executive Director of TRALAC. Under whose auspices this workshop is running. Now, thank you very much, and I know you'll remain here, as it were, with us. At this point, though, members, we'd like to welcome, this is Professor Colin McCarthy. Professor Colin McCarthy is an associate of TRALAC and a former head of the Economics Department at Stellenbosch University. Thank you very much for giving us this time this morning then, Professor McCarthy. And we are running a little late, and we're not going to cut you short at all. So what we're looking at, I see you've got two issues you'll be sharing with us this morning, and we start now at 10:40, and we could go on quite safely till 11:20, when I know members will feel that their constitutions require them to take just a short break. And, of course, we would like them to do so. But that break would be very short, enabling you to simply fetch a cuppa or whatever in 7 minutes. So we will give you that break. So thank you very much, and it's over to yourself now, Prof.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you and to share some thoughts with you this morning on the topic of trade and industrial policy in a customs union. Obviously, with specific reference, honourable members, to the Southern African Customs Union, I will really do my best to be as short as possible to allow time for discussion and questions. I might also just add that some of what I prepared might be a bit redundant in view of Trudy Hartzenberg's presentation. Because there will be an element of repetition. Unfortunately, I haven't been in a position recently to closely collaborate with my colleagues on presentations and so forth. I can just master the electronics quickly. No, fine.
I don't let that worry you, just so that members don't get too concerned. Presentation is just being photostatted at the moment. You will be getting it shortly.
The topics I will be covering, and some of them will be of a very introductory nature, will be just, again, to revisit the definition of a customs union, which is rather relevant in the case of SACU, especially if we start comparing it to other exercises of this nature. Then, very briefly also, what do we mean by trade and industrial policy? Trudy discussed this, and I'm sure you are in a better position than I am, given the agenda of this committee to speak on a topic like this. Then I will raise a few issues or questions on import tariffs, and then specifically continue with a discussion of SACU, the Customs Union, the SAC, Southern African Customs Union, and the tariff then within the customs union, which is a unique element, a defining feature of a customs union, and then link this to trade and industrial policy. I will then move towards the end and hopefully what I've considered to be the essence of my presentation this morning, just sharing some views with you and
you will excuse me or pardon me if I'm in some respects a bit provocative on policy implications and the challenges you face, and then I'll make a few concluding remarks. As has been made clear, if you consider regional integration in a linear format, in a linear form, then you can define a customs union as a free trade area of members sharing a common external tariff. It's the second step or the second phase in the linear model of regional integration that starts with the free trade area, carries on to the implementation of a common external tariff. And as we will note later on, this is a very important issue for trade and industrial policy. And from there on, you could move to a common market, as we have in Europe. And then finally, a European Union, which we already, an economic union, which we already partially have in the case of those countries of member states of the European Union that also belong to the euro currency zone. By definition, and this is important, unfortunately, I'm not sure I missed the first part of Trudy's presentation, but by definition, and in accordance with Article 24 of the GATT, a customs union is closely defined as trade in goods. It's free trade in goods. As soon as you start adding services, you get elements of a common market. So when we refer to the SACU as a customs union, in the first place, it's meant to refer free trade in goods behind a common external tariff. There are very good arguments why this should be expanded, and in some cases already we have an expansion of this if you link the SACU agreement to the common monetary agreement area, where we have monetary integration, and in the case also with countries like Lesotho, labor market integration. So in the case of Lesotho, you can already claim that we have a common market within a customs union, because there's a relatively free flow of labor, mostly obviously from Lesotho into South Africa, and they belong to a common monetary agreement, as Trudy explained, which means that they adopt the rand as legal tender, and the Lesotho currency is linked at par to the South African rand. And those of you who travel in the region will know that in Maseru you can pay in rand and even expect your change if you pay in the local currency in rand. The same applies in Swaziland and Namibia. So partially, yes, they are already closely linked trade in services. SACU, the point has already been made, is a unique animal. It dates back to 1910, and its very nature refers to the fact that this was an economic agreement, a pragmatic agreement, to deal with the economic integration of separate, independent, not necessarily independent in terms of their constitutions, but separate national entities. As we know, at the time of union, it was South Africa, the Union of South Africa, and the so-called High Commission territories of Bechuanaland, Swaziland, and Basutoland that formed the customs union. And often in literature, you will come across the reference that Lord Gladstone, at that stage, the Governor General and whatever his title was in the High Commission territories, signed four times to conclude the customs union agreement. And I recall, you know, I've had so many visits from people who, especially in the late 90s, came to South Africa, and they picked up this reference to this oldest operating customs union in the world. And they come from developing countries where they're trying to achieve regional integration with little success. And they came to South Africa and they spoke to people who they thought knew something of this. And they said, but can't we replicate this? What lessons can we learn? And it was always a bit disheartening to tell them that really, it's impossible, as Sudhi already explained, to replicate the SACU elsewhere. The fact of the matter is it's a historical legacy we're dealing with, and this also explains why it's so difficult, in a sense, to implement the 2002 agreement, which currently forms the legal instrument for the operation of the customs union. Because the new operation, or how we now wish to manage or are committed to manage the customs union, is a kind of a proactive process applied to something that already exists. It's not like Mercosur, where independent countries in a region came together and said, let's form a customs union. What must we do to achieve this? Or in the East African community, or in the best example of all, the European Union, where we know the political agenda and political objectives initially drove the exercise, the effort to form this that customs union eventually. And then a final point on this page is to note that, and Trudy already referred to this, and often we tend to ignore this point, or some observers tend to ignore the point. SACU is not only a customs union, it's also an excise union. This makes it also very unique, because even in Europe, you don't have an excise union. As you will know, with all the Brits taking the ferry into France to buy cheaper wine. It's they've got a different dispensation when it comes to excise duty there. And for them also, in terms of revenue distribution, they're not interested in a customs tariff as a source of revenue. I don't think, well, it's not even distributed among member states. It's used to finance, or it goes into the little kitty that finances the commission. And this excise union also has certain implications if we negotiate a customs union agreement. And I know that in the negotiation of the 2002 agreement, there was a strong, well, not a wish, a desire perhaps, on South Africa's part to exclude excise revenue from the revenue pool, to take it out of the customs union. But because of our porous borders with our neighboring states, the other member states, it's very difficult to operate separate, independent excise systems. Madam Chair, this takes me on to trade and industrial policy, and I'm sorry, once a teacher, always a teacher, and if I come across rather pedantic on definitions, I apologize for that. But I'm
listening with interest to your anecdotes. Go ahead.
I can keep you busy the whole day with anecdotes. I spent 6 years on the International Trade Administration Commission, chairing it for many years, and that provided quite a few anecdotes on relevant issues. Fine, I'll do that. When we think, and this is the point, you see, we often talk of trade and industrial policy as if these are two separate policy domains. They are not. Broadly speaking, we are dealing here with what I refer to as selective, and I emphasize the word selective, intervention by government to allocate resources to more productive use in an effort to address so-called market failures. If I can use an example, for example, in terms of regional development within a national state, we might decide that there's a market failure in taking development to the Eastern Cape. Therefore, we require government intervention through appropriate regional development policies to stimulate or encourage development in that area, because the market fails in achieving that. This is how I would define it, and broadly speaking, this is how it's defined in the literature. But unfortunately, like many things in economics, you will always find diverse views, especially on definitions, and in particular with respect to industrial and trade policy, because some people tend to see it in a very narrow sense. You will understand why I, on the basis of this definition, and I'll defend this definition wherever I go, this is why I regard the new growth plan, as an industrial policy. It's a broader industrial policy, whether we look at the macroeconomic instruments it proposes or considers, like the exchange rate, the interest rate, fiscal regimes, or whatever. What you're trying to do is you're trying to intervene in the market and influence the allocation of resources from what you perceive to be less productive to more productive use. I know if you read that document, and I'm now way off the topic this morning, but if you read the document, you will note that within the document, under the microeconomic policy package, they refer to industrial policy in a narrower sense. But as far as I'm concerned, the whole strategy is an industrial policy. Now, the definition where in the literature and why we still distinguish the two, why we treat them slightly separately, is the fact that that the application differs. Trade policy refers to any instrument used by government that influences relative prices of tradable products at the border of the country. In other words, if we implement a tariff which changes the price of the imported good vis-a-vis the price of the domestically produced competing product, then obviously we have a trade policy instrument in the tariff. If in some way or other we can get around the WTO and start subsidizing exports, then obviously that's also an instrument of trade policy. Industrial policy then refers to any other instrument that impacts on relative prices of production factors, labor, capital, whatever, and goods or products within the national economy, within the borders of a country. Therefore, if Parliament in its wisdom agrees to adopt legislation that will extend fiscal incentives to industry to form capital, to invest, that's part of industrial policy. If Parliament accepts policy measures in legislation that will have an impact on the allocation, the cost, and the use of labor, that's part of industrial policy. This then covers the definition of the two terms. However, these days, convention is to regard trade policy as an element of industrial policy. I will come back to the point that Trudy has already made that in South Africa's case, for example, we've always placed, since 1925, going back to those days, we've placed an emphasis on the tariff as an instrument of industrial policy. If I can carry on to the next slide, import tariffs. The point has already been made this morning, and I'm sure you appreciate this very well, that customs duties, as I've already said, serve as an instrument of industrial policy. It provides protection against imported competing goods. But, and this is where the dilemma comes in, this is where the problem we face with in SACU comes in. The tariff is also a source of revenue. And for countries that have a weak domestic tax base, they don't have many people earning high enough incomes that can serve as a source of personal income tax. They don't have a strong corporate sector where they can levy company taxation. And this applies in many African countries, including, and this is the problem, some of our SACU member states. For some of these countries, the tariff is a very important source of revenue. In fact, tax on trade, foreign trade, including exports, serve as a very important source of revenue. This is why you will find in some developing countries, including those in Africa, that have a heavy concentration in their export basket of primary products. They will have an export levy, export tax, on those export products. And then obviously, one of the more easily implementable type of taxes would be a tax on imported goods. And I recall at one stage in the whole debate on revenue sharing within SACU, some of the consultants operating on behalf of the BLNS economies argued that the average or typical African country, sub-Saharan African country, can expect, if it's not an oil exporting economy, can expect to earn what they call a 20% revenue rate through tariffs. Revenue rate being the return you get on the value of your imports, which is very high. And I tried to check that, and as far as I could determine empirically, it's not the case. Very few countries can raise a 20% or realize a 20% revenue rate on import tariffs as a source of revenue. Now, the point has repeatedly now been made that South Africa has always viewed the tariff primarily as an instrument of industrial policy. And this is a source of contention within SACU. Because our member states, our fellow member states within SACU, especially countries like Lesotho, Swaziland, and then in a second order, Namibia, and also now Botswana, regard the tariff as a source of revenue. And that has distinct implications for how we manage the customs union. But South Africa's always viewed the tariff as an instrument of industrial policy. As I said before, I served for quite a few years on ITAC, which is the body that manages the South African tariff or the SACU tariff. And I don't recall ever once that we actually considered the revenue implications of an application for a change to the tariff. It was just not on the table. The sole criterion was what will the impact be on the development of industry. That's been my experience, and it's always been like this. I also want to make the point that policy documents, specifically the National Industrial Policy Framework, and then following from that the Industrial Policy Action Plan, the second version, commit government to a refinement of the data structure. In other words, in our current policy documents, we are committed to use the tariff as an instrument of industrial development. And I know that ITAC has been tasked to review the tariff, lowering tariffs upstream where it has an impact on the production of inputs for downstream industries, to lower those tariffs, and then a more careful, and they're very careful how they formulate this in the Industrial Policy Action Plan, a more careful strategic treatment of downstream industries in implementing a developmental trade policy. Therefore, you would have a tendency to lower tariffs on, say, for example, steel. That's been removed, by the way. And then hopefully downstream protect the motor vehicle industry, for example, or the clothing industry, or whatever, by keeping fairly high protective tariffs in place for those industries. A second point that becomes relevant with respect to import tariffs, if you consider preferential trade agreements, those agreements usually relate to the tariff. How do we deal with the tariff? And South Africa, if you read all policy documents, and Trudy mentioned a few new ones that might appear in the not too distant future, South Africa is committed to the conclusions of preferential trade agreements involving trade and the tariff. Even, and I'm not sure on this, there's one thing which I've set myself to do yet, is to really go into some depth into what it means to be a member of BRICS. And what will the implications be in terms, or rather for our trade policy? And will this have an impact on the tariff decisions we take and we will be required to take? You can immediately see red flags going up, because how can we compete in a broad range of manufactured products with countries like China, Brazil, and India? But this is something that I will have to go into more depth, and I will depend on my colleagues, students of law, that will be hopefully be able to guide me in this. If we now turn to the customs union, SACU, I've got grown children and grandchildren, and even my grandchildren tell me I'm technologically retarded. So, SACU, the tariff and industrial/trade policy. Now, the important point, and this has already been made, we talk about South Africa managing the tariff. And again, we did it with the principal goal of developing South African industry in a particular way. But the tariff we're using is not only the South African tariff, it's the SACU tariff. It's managed, it applies also to imports going into Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland. We share, as I pointed out earlier, and Trudy also, we share a common external tariff. Now, in the past, and even to this day, because of institutional developments, not yet having caught up with the full implementation of the 2002 agreement, the tariff in all its manifestations is managed by South African agencies. Why do I emphasize in all its manifestations? Often the problem is that we only think in terms of the nominal or the effective tariff as it applies to import goods classified through standard conventions. What we tend to forget, that linked to this, to the tariff, we have a whole spread of instruments that we use in industrial policy. For example, we've got trade remedies. South Africa is one of the top users in the world, members of the WTO, in the use of anti-dumping duties, which is a special tariff we use to protect ourselves against what we define in terms of the GATT as unfair trade. But apart from that, if you study the Customs and Excise Act in South Africa, you will note the number of annexes there, which provide for rebates, tariff rebates, which are given selectively to industry. For example, a company that export a particular product can claim a 47003 rebate. In other words, it can import products, intermediate products, duty-free under the condition that the imports will be incorporated in goods that are exclusively exported, intended for the export market. So this is a very important instrument in encouraging export production, and we all agree that's what we should be doing. There's also a duty drawback system in place for firms that export part of their output and therefore wish to first to pay the duty, unlike the rebate system, pay the duty and afterwards claim back. This is what the term drawback refers to, claims back the duty paid on the imported products incorporated in the component of the output that went into the export markets. And then there are other industrial rebates as well. There's a whole series of these. And these are all managed by South African agencies, specifically the International Trade Administration Commission. Now, this is to change if we fully implement the 2002 SACU agreement. Because under this agreement, we are to establish a tariff board, an independent tariff board, that will sit not in Pretoria, but in Windhoek, where the secretariat is based. And this tariff board will not be, well, it will consist of independent members nominated by the member states, but not representing the member states, if you understand what I'm trying to say. All of you, honorable members, represent a particular constituency which you derive from the political party you belong to. This is not supposed to be how the tariff board will operate. Yes, Lesotho will have its nominated person serving there. South Africa will have its nominated person serving there. But they are not supposed to get instructions from head office, from the capitals, on how they should vote on customs issues. And all of these decisions on the tariff and the tariff derivatives, trade remedies, etc., will, once the tariff board is up and running, will have to be taken by the tariff board on the basis of consensus. This is what the customs union agreement requires. Customs are decisions by consensus, and from the tariff board it will go to the council, the supreme governing body of the customs union, where decisions will also be taken on the basis of consensus. Furthermore, what is relevant is that Article 38, Trudy Hartzenberg already referred to this, of the SACU agreement, commits member states to the development of common industrial policies. To inter alia address economic inequalities between member states, among the member states. This is very clear, a very clear intention with the common industrial policies and the whole operation of the customs union, is to address attention to the inequality between or among the member states, specifically between South Africa on the one hand and the very small BLNS economies on the other hand. And the final point I wish to, at this point, of Gerard Erasmus, the lawyer in our group, would like to make the point that SACU is a legal entity. I'm not sure, Gerard, whether that's the correct description. It's a legal, it's a single legal entity, and Article 31 of the Customs Union Agreement requires us to establish a common mechanism in negotiations with third parties. In other words, anything dealing with tariffs or related to tariffs must be dealt with through a common negotiating mechanism where SACU will negotiate, and not South Africa, or Botswana, or Lesotho, or whatever. It will be SACU that will negotiate. Fine, this takes me onto the policy implications and challenges we face, against the background of some of the points I've made. And this is where I might, Madam Chair, tend to be a bit provocative. Hopefully, you would be able to enlighten me on some of these issues, which I do not, as an external observer, do not always find very clear. Now, the first point I'm fairly certain of, because I've participated in different exercises with members of the DTI and so forth, on this issue of committing South Africa with the other member states to developing common industrial policies. Now, this, in view of what I've explained, of the tariff being an instrument of industrial policy, it stands to reason that a customs union, if it uses the tariff as an instrument of industrial policy, cannot adopt diverse industrial policies, contradictory policies. Now, the question I ask is, how does one reconcile, and this is a very old question, and it's been asked very often, how does one reconcile the diverse development needs of disparate economies with South Africa producing roughly 94% of SACU GDP. And we must remember this is creating certain problems. How do you devise a policy that can use the tariff as an instrument of development to steer South African industry and a particular industry and the Lesotho industry into some other direction, for example? This is a totally, totally diverse economy. So this is a problem. And I'm not sure what will come out of this debate. I've changed my own perception on this, that we should at least try to adopt a common vision of where we want to go with the industrial development of SACU. The second challenge or problem I raise is, how does one, and this has been raised already by Trudy, how does one reconcile South Africa's need to use the SACU tariff and its derivatives as instruments of industrial policy with the BLNS emphasis on the tariff as a source of revenue? I recall not many years ago, after the new revenue distribution formula came into operation, I've been approached by quite a few people from the BLNS countries who asked me, you know, is it possible to do research to see what the cost to the revenue pool of the South African rebate system is? You're providing a lot of rebates to industry. That obviously comes out of the common revenue pool. What is the cost to us of that industrial policy? And bear in mind that these decisions on rebates, decisions on trade remedies, whether it's a customs anti-dumping duty or a countervailing duty trying to protect us against subsidized imports, this will require a consensus decision by both the tariff board and council. And to use an extreme example, it's quite possible for one of these countries to decide, well, if we really get subsidized cheese out of Europe or whatever, or canned tomatoes or whatever because of the common agricultural policy, I mean, it's not, there's a separate agreement, it's a bad example, but you know where I'm going. Why would we? We haven't got a tomato canning industry in Lesotho. Why should we be concerned about having the benefit of a cheap imported product because of subsidies? Why would we be concerned about a particular anti-dumping duty? Because it's not going to impact on our industry. It's only going to impact on the South African industry, which is the only industry that, by definition, in terms of the anti-dumping agreement, will ever qualify for anti-dumping duties. Another point is in the new dispensation, and this is where I'm perhaps being a bit provocative, because I can't work out how this is going to work. In the new dispensation, where we will have an independent tariff board responding to submissions of member state national bodies. Each member state, South Africa, for example, currently ITAC is still operating as the tariff board, if we could call it that, for the whole customs union. But once we have a tariff board in place, then ITAC will revert to its status as the national body for South Africa. And the BLNS countries will each also have a national body. They will do trade tariff investigations. They will submit reports to the tariff board with recommendations that the tariff board will have to consider. But the whole exercise starts with the national bodies. My question is, should the Minister of Economic Development be the choice to represent South Africa and the South African in the SACU Council? Because under the new dispensation, ITAC, specifically ITAC is very important in the context of what I'm trying to say now, but also the IDC and the Competition Commission, but primarily ITAC, of importance to my mind, now is reporting to the Minister of Economic Development and no longer to the Minister of Trade and Industry. But the Minister of Trade and Industry still represents South Africa at the national body. But once we have a tariff board in place, how will that work? From my own experience, recalling our own experiences at ITAC, where we reported to the Minister of Trade and Industry, he accepted recommendations on tariff changes or whatever, and then requested the Minister of Finance to implement the change. How will it henceforth work? And also in trade negotiations, who will, in this common mechanism and in council, who will represent the South African view? Where does this leave the DTI and the minister? I'm going on to my conclusion, honourable members. Just a few loose remarks in this respect. SACU, the 2002 agreement, is undoubtedly, and especially once it's fully implemented, will act as a constraint on the South African industrial policy space. It will not be possible anymore or any longer then to act kind of independently and just consult very briefly perhaps our fellow member states in SACU. Policy decisions will be taken out of the hands of South African agencies and will rest with supranational customs union organizations. Second problem flag, which I would like to flag is sometimes, and I hope my colleagues don't hold me this against me, I ask myself, do we really have a workable customs union agreement in place? And I'm not only thinking of the revenue distribution mechanism, but also other elements of the customs union. Can it really work? And I wouldn't like to express any views on how to go forth on that. How do you continue in that respect? The further point I would raise in conclusion is that with all its warts and what, insufficient attention is given to SACU and implications of membership for development and regional economic development specifically. I hold the view, and I've always held this, and I know that Minister Davies also shares this view, is that SACU can, within SADC, serve as a building block of deeper regional integration. There was a question by an honourable member earlier about the position of SACU vis-a-vis SADC. But the fact of the matter is, we could not stick to the road map for SADC of having a customs union implemented in 2010 that was postponed. But within SADC, we do have a customs union, and there's often talk of expanding the membership, surely not under the current revenue sharing mechanism. But there's always been talk, and I know often you will come across references to Mozambique's desire to become a member of the customs union. And then the final remark, and this Trudy already touched on, is how can we expand SACU trade in goods to include services, especially bearing in mind the dual system that we have in place of a trade agreement, free trade with a common external tariff, and with the exclusion of one member, Botswana, we have a fairly high degree of monetary integration. And even Botswana, if you consider their exchange rate mechanism, you will note that the pull-off closely follows the rand because they adopt a weighted basket approach to determining the value of the pula, and you will note that it closely follows the rand because of the dominance of South African imports into the Botswana economy. So we have these two agreements in place as it is, and this could provide a platform for further expansion of regional integration of South Africa, with granted for, compared to South Africa, very small economies. Thank you, Manager.
Well,
Well, thank you very much, Professor McCarthy. Thank you. Now, it is just 25 past 11, and in a number of ways, having already got the fundamentals in place with Ms. Hartzenberg, we had a deepening in certain areas, with a focus on two key areas meaning the implications of that, but perhaps more, you know, there was greater depth and information and experiences shared on the trade industrial policy interface. So, members, I'm looking for five short questions from members, and let's not try and go beyond, shall we say, 30 seconds, 40 seconds for each input, a maximum of a minute if you can get two questions in. I'll take a show of hands. Right, Honourable Kristen Tooley, yes, Dr. Harvey, and also Honourable Vandermeer, Sue Vandermeer. Right, do go ahead.
That's Jefferson. I just wanted to correct that ITEC is reporting to both economic development and the trade and industry. Not that it has, all of it has been transferred to economic development. So it is reporting to both ministers. Maybe the argument is to base on that one. Thanks.
Sorry, can I just have clarity on, are you saying they're reporting to both ministers?
Different aspects of ITEC. I think the beauty of this is that the Honourable Ntuli used to be our first whip, I think it was about 7-6 months, and was there at the coal face, as it were, and is now in economic development, say, at the other coal face, another seam of coal, all right? I'm sure we can go into that a bit more, and we can also share with you some of the information we did receive. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Professor McCarthy. I think it was a very thought-provoking submission of yours. In your conclusion, you've made some statements which I think I'd like to have further clarity. You say SACWA is a constraint on South African industrial policy space. I'd like to, if it's possible, I'd like you to finish with some examples. Why is it such a constraint? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable
Vandermeer. Chair, I can't be 30 seconds in what I want to say, but I also want to know, because my questions are more broad questions about issues that we need to tackle, and I just want to know, are you going to have opportunity afterwards for this broader discussion, or shall I raise those questions now?
If I may, I wanted to get these questions on the table and break the tea, others who walk past take our tea.
Okay, then I will put the question. And the first question that I think we need to ask, and you will understand that I come from my previous employer with regard to this, and that is, what are South Africa's interests in all this? What are South Africa's interests? How do we align what we're doing in regional integration with our work on the African continent? How do we align some of these big and complex questions with how we see ourselves as a region and as an African continent? And I think that the answer to that partly lies in the fact that South Africa's interests are linked inextricably with the interests of the region, and that therefore it is one of our interests to deepen regional economic integration. And the question then is, how do we do it without losing our vision of a united and deepened regional economic community? The second question is around revenue sharing. And I think, is it Dr. Hartzenberg? Just truly, okay. I think she referred to this question. We have never linked revenue sharing to development. And I think that this is a very critical question that we need to confront. How do we say, because let's face it, South Africa is in a completely different position to every single other one of our partners in SACU, and for that matter, SADC. So our objective should relate to the way in which we see development of our region, and therefore those transfers should enable us to develop corridors, to develop industry upstream and downstream. But to see SADC, and the kernel of SADC is, of course, SACU, as one great trading area, because it is certainly in South Africa's interest, in my view, South Africa as one country is actually small fry, and that's where the whole BRICS question comes in again, and I have a strong view about that, which I won't share at this moment, but we are small fry. If you include SADC in our trading area, you've got a whole different kettle of fish. It's a much more attractive opportunity for investment and for trade if you look at SADC as a whole. And therefore, I think we must see this as a vision that we move towards. Professor McCarthy raised the question of the linear model of integration. And I would like to submit that we need to look at other models, not necessarily the linear model leading from free trade area to a common external tariff, customs union to common area, that we could do other things. And I submit that the first way to do that is to, in detail, implement our free trade area and work from our free trade area in linking with the other regions of the African continent to, amongst others, promote trade with the rest of the continent, but also to strengthen our position as an integrated trading partner. I knew it would be more than 30 seconds, and I apologize. Right.
Just let me inquire as to our support staff down there, busy loading bottles. Hello, ma'am. I think don't load any more. Just leave those bottles alone, if I may suggest. I've got my own boxes as well. No, just leave them alone. Right. But now that we'll just be almost ready for our tea, I'm sorry we ran out of time, because it reminded me when you mentioned linear, it really is a very Cartesian approach, if I may suggest. And I think we've long since moved from that. I would hope we have. And from the rest of what you gave us, I realized implicit in your presentation was a shift from Cartesian approach. So it may be that it's sort of semantics and one thing, but I think it's a little bit more. We need certainly to do a shift from linear modeling. I really believe that, because I think therein lies a possible solution. You've raised a number of issues, and I'm not even going to suggest that even in this room we have the answers, because I don't think we're looking for answers. This is the question, this is the answer, but rather what are the challenges, and I think you've given us that. And we may need to ask and say, there's no way we're giving up our industrial policy, you know, per se, the reindustrialization of South Africa. On the other hand, we're also not giving up the pursuit of regional integration in a fair and equitable manner. So how do these meet? Now, is there any way we can synchronize that in a broader vision? And I think when we come back after refreshing our minds, our tea, you know, tea does a wonderful thing and coffee, let's come back and do just that. Thank
Chair,
you. But members, don't disappear off this corridor, please.
Chair, may I be so arrogant as to ask? Unfortunately, I'm facing very serious personal problems at the moment, and I've got to leave as soon as possible. Can I quickly answer or just address, if the honourable members will bear with me?
And just before you conclude then, may we say, we're going to then have to invite you back, because we really can only give you a three-minute response.
Fine.
And I don't think that will be sufficient.
First, Chair, I would like to thank you for this information on ITAC now reporting to both ministers. From my own experience, this is creating more questions and problems in my own mind. And I would like to have some feedback from you, some information on this. I also to talk to my ex-colleagues at ITAC, and I have difficulty in envisaging how that works, but in any case. SACU's constraint on industrial policy space, what do I actually mean by that? The fact of the matter is that South Africa cannot now independently decide on a tariff with notification, for example, to our BLNS partner states. Whether it's the tariff, the nominal tariff, which we wish to change for the sake of industrial development, whether it's a rebate, whether it's a trade remedy, all decisions we can investigate through our national body, report to the tariff board, who will then decide and make a recommendation to the council. The honourable member van der Merwe, what is South Africa's interest in all of this? Obviously, I mean, we can carry on this point. I mean, it's very important for South Africa. We are, after all, part of the African continent. And the African market is our natural market. But if you read the new growth path, for example, you will note there that one of the, and I'll come back to your point, Chair, of the linear model. One of the problems there is that we find ourselves in what you could call a mercantilist trade pattern with the rest of Africa. We export to Africa and, in return, import very little from Africa, more or less a 7-to-1 ratio. And the reason for that is not only the protection of South African industry, but it's also the scope, the capacity to produce tradable goods that can be sold in the South African market, elsewhere in Africa. And this is why the emphasis falls on creating that capacity, and that is not created through a religious following of the linear model, which unfortunately has been the undoing of regional integration in Africa. And I'm on record, TRALAC has got a publication, it's now been widely publicized to, in UN publications as well, on why I don't think that the conventional paradigm based on the linear model really works. And I agree with you, Chair, and the honorable member, that we will have to look elsewhere. Revenue sharing linked to development, we know that's the South African argument, is it? Currently, the revenue forms part of recurrent revenue. It's unconditional transfers to the BLNS countries, and that could change. Whether SADC will be such a different kettle of fish, even with SADC, South Africa, I mean, in world terms, we're small. But in Africa, we're a giant. And even within SADC, we still remain a giant. And I've always seen SACU as a small stepping stone in the further integration of SADC. Briefly.
Thank you most sincerely. We really appreciate the time you did give us. And we're definitely going to continue our debates on the matter. Thank you. Look, members, let's all work together on this one and be back within 8 minutes if we can.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. I will keep that deadline in mind. Ladies and gentlemen, my presentation to you is as indicated there on the legal and institutional dimension of SACU. Now, why is that important? Why are we fitting it in? Well, if they didn't put in that topic, they couldn't invite me. I had to speak about something. Secondly, the legal and institutional dimension is important because of the powers that are involved and because of the legal relationships that are involved. This is a rules-based mechanism, so it is not possible for the members simply to carry on and adopt unilateral policies and decisions as if there isn't a legal corpus of principles that have to be taken into account. So that is the justification. The law does matter in these international trade arrangements, and I want to share with you some of those features. That is the overview of what I will speak about. what, from a technical and legal point of view, is a customs union. I think that has been covered. The basic features from the 2002 SACU agreement, that's the present one, some recent developments in SACU, in SADC, the tripartite FTA. I don't know whether you have covered that treaty. A little bit about economic partnership agreements and negotiations. Then the question number seven, what does this all mean for the South African Parliament? And then, as I see it at least, and then concluding remarks. Now, ladies and gentlemen, SACU is an international legal person. Why is it an international legal person? Because the SACU agreement, the present agreement of 2002, which entered into force in 2004, declares and has established it as an international legal person. It means it has certain powers, it can conclude certain agreements, enter into contracts, sue and be sued and so on, and diplomatic privileges and immunities for the officials are involved. Now, from a technical point of view, we have to remember that a customs union is not an arrangement open for the member state to determine what it is. It has to fit into the multilateral rules of the WTO and before that the GATT. So although it is a trade arrangement and although it is directly relevant for regional integration exercises, after all, why do states enter into this type of agreement? Why do they have customs unions? Apart from the policy and trade and integration benefits or considerations, there are also legal and institutional matters that we have to take into account. This is not a free-for-all when we engage with these organizations and when they exercise their own powers and interact with third parties. The WTO has a set of rules. And the basic rule, as we all know, is non-discrimination in international trade. So when a particular group of countries come together and they constitute, they form a free trade area or a customs union, in terms of which they grant special privileges to each other, then in principle that is a violation of the non-discrimination, the MFN rule. So the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, one of the pillars of the WTO, allows these regional arrangements like customs unions and FTAs to be established, provided certain rules are met. And those rules basically, in the case of a customs union, deal with the single customs territory requirement, it deals with the common external tariff, and then there are rules about the fact that the customs union may not be used, once it is established, to raise barriers vis-a-vis third parties, in other words, other members of the WTO. And this whole arrangement must cover substantially all trade and must be notified to the WTO institutions, and it is not a platform for new and additional commercial obstacles to be created. So, once a customs union or an FTA complies with these requirements and that process is monitored, it is a WTO-compatible arrangement, and it has to be kept alive in that context, alive while complying with these multilateral rules. Now, point number six there is just to confirm something which is known. Because it is a single customs territory, it means that there are no rules of origin for the members of the customs union. They may be for third parties, but not internally. And in principle, point number seven, there should be no obstacle at the borders between the member states. In other words, if wine is exported from the Cape to restaurants and hotels in Windhoek, at the border there at Noord Oever and Vuurstof, no tariffs are involved. What may happen there, and that is necessary in inter alia because of the trade data that is required, is that the customs officials there will have a look at the documentation and they will control the the correctness of that information, but no tariffs are involved. It's a single customs territory. I just want to mention, and I've picked up from the previous discussion, that you've already started to discuss the bigger issues, namely, what is the Republic's policies and preferences with respect to engaging the rest of the continent, the African continent, and where does an arrangement like SACU fit into that? May I just mention that in the bigger scheme of things, the African Union has embarked on a very ambitious plan for deeper integration in Africa. Sometimes one hears of the United States of Africa and one single currency, etc. I personally am very skeptical about that, but be that as it may, these customs unions and free trade areas are the building blocks in terms of their view on deeper integration in Africa. And we've got them all over the place. We've got them in the East African community, and we've got them in COMESA. So although we may criticize that type of thinking because of the linear model approach that you've already referred to in your previous discussion, and although we may say that it's unrealistic, at least in this formal sense, there is a factor here that we can identify as a formal building block in the manner in which the African Union philosophy identifies these regional economic communities. SACU isn't sitting very nicely in that because it's a lot older, it's 100 years older, but the legal institutional arrangements are familiar. Basic features of the SACU agreement. As I've said, it is an international organization. It has a number of institutions. What are those institutions? It's the Council of Ministers, which is the highest decision-making body. Then there is the Commission of Senior Trade Officials or Financial Officials. Those two institutions are actually remnants from the previous dispensation, from the 69 agreement. What is new under the new agreement is the Permanent Secretariat, which is in Windhoek, and provision is made for a tribunal and a tariff board. Professor Colin McCarthy discussed the tariff board, I heard, and I happen to know that the SACU member states are also at present looking at draft annexes for putting up the and finally establishing the tribunal. Now, the position is interesting. There is a provision in the agreement, and I've got it here, the agreement. It says SACU has the following institutions: Council, Commission, Technical Liaison Committees, Secretariat, Tariff Board, and the Tribunal. So, formally speaking, the Tribunal and the Tariff Board are already there. They are in existence, but they require additional annexes, additional legal instruments to provide for the detail. And that brings one to the point where one can observe that SACU is not fully consolidated yet. All the building blocks are not in place. I also want to mention that there is a possibility for expanding the scope, the coverage of what this agreement deals with, because Article 42 of the agreement provides for additional annexes to be adopted. That article mentions annexes for competition, for agriculture, for industrial policy, and for unfair trade practices. So it's not a static structure or organization. It is supposed to be interacting with the world around it and to expand it and consolidate its own activities. One important thing, and Professor McCarthy mentioned it, is to ask about what is the role of SACU, and more specifically the Secretariat, when it comes to negotiating new trade agreements. And I'm going to deal with that in a minute, but let me just repeat what he has said. If SACU is a customs union with a common external tariff and has to maintain that in its interaction with the rest of the world, the WTO and the multilateral rules, It means that members of SACU cannot be member. You can't be a member of more than one SACU, customs union. Customs unions can merge or can expand, but you cannot be a member of more than one customs union. And it also means that if you then, as a block, as a customs union, negotiate new trade agreements, like the one with Mercosur, which is there already to some extent, with India there are negotiations, with the United States, and there are frequent mentions, it is mentioned that new SACU agreements, free trade agreements or additional agreements are to be discussed. It means that the member states have to coordinate their tariff offers. Now, if you really have a strong and a well-developed regional institution, then, of course, somewhere that voice that will speak on behalf of the collective will enjoy the necessary powers to do so. And that is, SACU is not there yet. The Secretariat does not negotiate on behalf of the members. So what does the Secretariat do? Well, the agreement tells us what the Secretariat is doing, and the Secretariat is increasingly looked upon by the smaller member states to assist it with respect to technical capacity challenges. The Secretariat plays an important role in terms of infrastructural support, and by that I mean meetings and organizing meetings, coordinating activities, and it provides and generates a lot of useful information and technical data. But there is a certain tension here about, and that is not only true of SACU, it's all over the world. If states embark on the road of deeper regional integration, one of the important things to decide is what powers are going to be granted to those institutions of the relevant organization. And the more advanced these regional structures become, the bigger the need for effective institutions with clear powers. And that is an area and a matter which I want to mention to you as of particular importance and has to be watched. And it is not only because SACU is a customs union more advanced, it is inevitably on the agenda of every regional organization, including SADC. And the extent to which these organizations are successful or less successful can, in one particular way, be measured in terms of the output and the efforts and the services of your secretariat. The other developments in SACU, ladies and gentlemen, Turi has already told you about the debate around the new revenue sharing formula. I'm not going to go into that. That matter is still on the table. It has not been finalized. Another interesting institution development is that SACU is going to have a summit. The present list of institutions does not include a summit. So the highest body, the highest institution, the strongest institution is the Council of Ministers. But the Council of Ministers is a platform for articulating the interests of the member states. One of the institutional weaknesses in SACU is the identity of the institution speaking on behalf of the collective. Colin said something about some institutional weaknesses, structural weaknesses, and here's another one. The clear identity and empowerment of that mechanism speaking on behalf of SACU is lacking. Now, the summit, what is the summit about? Most regional organizations in Africa, SADC included, they will have, as the highest organ, the highest institution, they will have the summit of heads of state or government. That's where the presidents and prime ministers gather from time to time. Now, the 2002 SACU agreement doesn't provide for that, but the organization has drifted into that position. So since about 2 years ago, ad hoc summits have been taking place. And that position is now going to be formalized. They're already working on the paperwork. And it might be that you will see that international agreement or the amendments to the SACU agreement coming to before Parliament and for you to fulfill your responsibilities under Section 231 of the Constitution. So that's an important development. Then it is into all sorts of trade negotiations. The tariff board is an important building block. The tribunal will be a very important building block. I personally hope that they will be established rather soon and that we will have clarity at least on the joint activities and also when the tribunal is there on the nature of the rules and the obligations and how they will be enforced. While these matters hang in the air, the rules-based dimension of this institution leaves a lot to be desired. It's not ideal if there is uncertainty, even if it is in the formal sense of the word. And then there are the trade negotiations, and I've also picked up that you have discussed the possibility that there will be a proper development fund once the revenue sharing formula is adapted or is changed. I want to mention that this agreement, the SACCO agreement, does refer to a development component, not a development fund, a development component, which is part of the present revenue sharing formula. It's about 50% of the excise tax going into that. I am not supposed to speak to about SADC, but I just want to mention to you, ladies and gentlemen, that all the member states, as you know, obviously know, all the SACCO member states are members of SADC. There are some overlapping activities taking place. SADC had rather bold and ambitious plans to become a customs union by 2010. That plan has been put in the back burner. What we have here, ladies and gentlemen, is, and I think Trudy has discussed with you, the other big trade negotiating development on the African continent, which is this effort to form the so-called tripartite FTA, Free Trade Area, which will literally start in the Cape and go up to Cairo. 26 African countries being members of SADC, COMESA, and the EAC are presently negotiating a free trade area, a tripartite free trade area, because of the three RECs that are involved. Now, one of the factors to consider is that in terms of the bigger picture, we have SACCO, we have SADC, and then these organizations are involved, their members are involved in bilateral trade. They are all, with one or two exceptions, members of the WTO. They are all actively participating in Geneva and the Doha round. They are negotiating economic partnership agreements with the European Union. They are deepening their efforts towards deeper integration in Africa, and they are, as far as we are concerned, negotiating the tripartite FTA. Now, that's a lot of action, and that can have not only far-reaching implications for freer trade and for the private sector and for commercial policies, but it will involve your functioning, your challenges, your oversight, your involvement in scrutinizing those activities and also when those agreements come before you. So we cannot go in all the detail, but one of the points I want to make is there's a lot of action going on out there, and it must make sense. They must speak to each other. And somehow you sit, as far as one member state is concerned, at a very pivotal position because you have to keep these things observed and be informed about them, and you have particular functions to fulfill. That is the tripart FTA, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not going to say too much about that now. That information will remain here. But keeping the stern reminder of the chair in mind, let me also not say too much about the economic partnership agreements. They've been going on for several years now. Some observers think they are running out of steam. Others say no, they will definitely be concluded by the end of the year, maybe downscaled in terms of the level of ambition. But the one point that we have to make about the EPAS, somehow we will have to normalize and formalize our trade with the European Union in order to make it WTO compatible. The Cotonou trade chapter is gone. Expired at the end of 2007, I think, and since that time, or even before that date, the European Union has started to negotiate these economic partnership agreements. There's been a lot of debate about it, about them being too ambitious and going way beyond the WTO and so on. By by the way, there's no purpose in concluding these special regional trade agreements and FTAs if they don't go WTO plus. Otherwise, why have them? So even if we scale down the coverage, the content, the ambition in these HEPAs, trade in goods will have to be regularized, so to speak, will have to be made WTO compatible. There is no legal basis for them at present. The EPAs are FTAs in the sense of Article 24 of the GATT that I've already mentioned. So somehow we will have to deal with that in any case. We cannot lose that very important market. But no one is really disputing that. It's about the level of ambition, I think, and how far they will go. Now, what does all of this mean for this institution, for the South African Parliament? You are far better placed to answer that than I am. But given the need for bringing the points of discussion together, I've tried to list a number of possible factors there that could answer, or points of information that could answer that question posed in the caption there. You obviously have a particular constitutional function to perform under Section 231 of the Constitution when it comes to the approval to be given to an important category of international agreements. Exactly how you do that and how you engage the executive branch of government which had negotiated those agreements, those are your internal rules and practices. One assumes that there will be the sufficient degree of transparency, of knowledge, of interaction, and so on. But that's a very important constitutional function. I think this parliament also has an oversight function generally, and it has obviously those other functions with respect to giving content to the participatory dimension, the budgetary financial dimension, and so on. And there are policy considerations out there involving not only the Ministry of Trade and Industry, but some others. Professor McCarthy has mentioned some of them. DIRCO is obviously the international relations dimension is there. So there are many, I think, challenging and interesting and exciting elements for you to be involved in, and keeping pace of all the developments in the bigger picture is obviously a specialized and quite a complicated task. One of the matters that I've picked up, and of course we know that policy making is the function of the executive branch of government, but in the short while that I was here this morning, I heard a number of questions about what is in it for us? Where are we going? Where is the region going? What about reconciling our regional activities and policies with the bigger picture? Not only the African picture, but the multilateral one. Now, all of those questions and considerations can be brought under the rubric of policy, leadership, initiatives, and there are many, many reasons why we need a stable region, why we need a prosperous region, and unfortunately this will not come about by just confirming and proclaiming that ideal or confirming that it is true. Something has to be done about it in terms of leadership, in terms of taking initiatives. Now, where do these regional organizations like SACU fit into that? Now, strictly speaking, they cannot generate policy on their own. They are not empowered to do so. They can facilitate debates. That is why we have the summit and the council and so on. But, ladies and gentlemen, there are three, maybe if you're lucky, four council meetings a year. The council will probably, the summit will probably meet once a year. And those ministers and those political leaders are very busy people with full programs. They cannot make a new policy between breakfast and lunch after, then before they leave again. So a lot has to be done in terms of thinking these things through and putting them through the pipeline. We need a debate, we need a discourse about these things. And I believe that your institution is obviously so important in that broader process that this fact deserves to be put also on to be put on that list. So let me then summarize, ladies and gentlemen, what have I shared with you? I've shared with you a description about SACO, which says that it is rules-based, it is it has a legal instrument as its constitution and agreement. It has to fit into the global, the multilateral picture. It has to comply with WTO rules. And then, of course, it has to comply with its own internal rules. How do we determine whether activities of SACO are lawful or not? Well, you compare it with the legal instrument which deals with that. And this question will only really be asked once that can only really be answered once the tribunal is there, because the tribunal will have the final say about the interpretation, the lawfulness of the activities, the actions, the implementation of the agreement or decisions, and questions about the interpretation of it. So that can be a very exciting development. Once we have the tribunal, there'll be a lot of new action around. Let me just remind you of the crisis in SADC at the moment about their tribunal. You will recall last August when the SADC summit met in Windhoek, one of the member states complained bitterly about this tribunal having ruled against it, the land issues in Zimbabwe, and of course it didn't want to comply with those rulings. The summit then decided to launch a new investigation into the powers and jurisdiction of the tribunal. And by the way, the summit didn't fully endorse the criticism of Zimbabwe. It was an open-ended set of principles to be investigated by this consultant. And that report has been complied. But despite what we read in the press, we cannot assume, and it's definitely not true, that the end of the SADC tribunal has arrived. No. Let's watch this space carefully. But once that legal and institutional aspect has been recognized, I think we must bring this debate down to the level of this floor, this institution. And that's why I, at the end, asked, what are the implications here and for us? And may I just share with you my concluding remarks. Just to be fancy, and to remind you that a long time ago, young aspiring lawyers had to study Latin before they could enter into that illustrious profession. It is not required anymore. I'm asking, quo vadis SACO? Where is SACO going? Quo vadis Southern Africa? Sounds a little bit more suitable for this august institution. Need for regional policy and leadership, the RECs. Now, I have recently written and shared ideas and platforms about the whole issue of sovereignty. And I'm throwing in sovereignty there towards the end. And I'm quite prepared to discuss sovereignty with you, because why is sovereignty up there? We increasingly hear voices, especially from politicians, that these regional institutions and their powers are a threat to sovereignty and to national policy making. I don't share that view. As a matter of fact, it's an act of sovereignty to conclude an international agreement and to establish an international organization. Countries cannot survive on their own. And by the way, we also forgot to teach the mosquitoes and diseases and criminals to respect sovereignty and national borders. They don't do. So let me conclude by just saying that these ideas are being left behind, but I hope I have succeeded, ladies and gentlemen, in making the point that legal and institutional aspects count. They are important. We have a rules-based structure in SACO, in SADC. They're not perfect, but they are increasingly evolving around that road, and it has implications for the performance of your function. I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very, very much, Professor Gerhardt Erasmus. There you certainly are cognizant of what we call approaching deadlines. Thank you very much. But without compromising the product. Now I will be over to our membership here. of clarification. So I immediately saw the Honorable Salal, followed by the Honorable Smale, Honorable Khadebe, and Honorable Dupinyama.
Chairperson, thanks. Maybe the professor should say to us whether there's a difference between remark and question. Because the heading concluding remarks is actually concluding questions. So there's perhaps no difference between remark and question. There are these three areas that are referred to, Chairperson, comprising of about 26 countries in Africa. Where are these places? Which three blocks and which countries are involved? The second question is, reference was made that you cannot belong to two custom unions. When you belong to a custom union, in terms of the World Trade Organization, you cannot belong to the other one. You belong to one, and that's one only. Now, when SADC discusses the issue of the establishment of a custom union, what are the implications on SACU? Will SACU members obviously have to close down in order to belong there or to resist that SADC has won? The third one is the issue of the national currency. The United States, UK, Europe are running on those particular kinds of currencies. You have your euro, your pound, and your US dollar. There are various options in different areas as to how it operates. I'm informed that the different countries in Europe have their own local currencies, and that the euro is a national, international kind of a trading currency. That is the one option. The other option is that of the USA, of having a dollar throughout, not only in the USA, in the entire America as a currency. What is the fear? How can't we, in the negotiations within African Union, look at options that could make issues of exchange much more easier? What is the fear? I heard you say you are you reserve your support to the idea of a national currency. Maybe if you can give us more about what are these things that should make us fearful, if we should be. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to link this with our previous speaker, Colin McCarthy. And it's on his... one of his conclusions when he spoke about the SACU's constraint into the South African industrial policy, and he's standing that when this 2002 SACU agreement actually comes into place, is the bilateral trade agreements between the various countries, and also in the one hand that Prof, that you said that we are responsible to make, or the body is responsible to make its own various regulations and rules. Would this then mean that any future bilateral agreement in the future concerning trade at all has got to go there now for some sort of approval by the body or by SANCO? I just would like to understand that one, because could there be a negative implication towards any existing ones that wasn't actually agreed to by all 26 countries that we might have with others, but are they presently, and looking at where our policy is actually driving us towards what we want to achieve as a goal.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think a person will start first by appreciating the input, very elucidative and then so good. But I also heard some skepticism about the issue of the common currency along SADC or along the union as a whole. So as the professor is an independent person from the politicians and the economists, I want his view now. Our brother leader at the top, Colonel Gaddafi, said that integration can be easily be achieved by starting first by politics, political integration. But South Africa was skeptical. It wanted more economic integration first before. So which one is the best option as a person with the funding who is able to look at both sides objectively? Thank you.
Yes, I'm not sure if current events would seem to give us a response, but let us go on to Honorable Nyama.
Madam Chair, the tripartite and the time frames for, is there any time frames for the negotiations and the within that the three and the blocks? And the you asked a question about the regional policy, whether we do have regional policy. I suppose the whole circle, which is supposed to be the platform that informs all these activities. I want to throw that question back to you. And in your view, is there a regional policy which is informing the various processes that you have alluded to? And if there's any citizen participation, is there any space for citizen participation and beneficiation of the ordinary people within the region based on all these activities? Because I suppose each and everything that we're supposed to do within the region, as we have alluded, it's supposed to benefit the ordinary people. And that basically those are the two questions.
Thank you. I have a question myself, which is really informed by a lack of background on my own part. You know, throughout this morning, and it was re-emphasized now, yes, we've got SACU. And yes, there's SADC, attempted to have the customs union, and then statements made you can only belong to one, and not all these several overlapping in Africa or whatever. And then towards the end, another statement, you know, unless South Africa regularizes these issues with the WTO, we will face serious problems. And although the phrase was not uttered, such as we would find possibly our arrangements with SACU almost invalidated as a result of the EPAs coming in. I myself was not too sure what we were saying, because yes, we are members of the WTO, and it would appear others are as well, but we are all members of SACU as well. And at the same time, there is talk of reaching out to the rest of Africa, the eastern Watson, I don't know what else, what, and one sees maps where you see the overlapping issue. Now, are we just, have they just sort of decided to cast a blind eye on our irregularities, and are they now saying, now you must regularize yourself? What is the actual issue? Because certainly those involved in the EPAs seem to think they're on very solid legal ground. So where are we?
May I fire away?
Please.
Yes. Okay. Let me start with this last question, Chair. How to make sense of what sometimes is described as a spaghetti bowl of overlapping regional and trade agreements?
We haven't got all our membership here.
I picked up the name that you mentioned, ma'am. It is important, ladies and gentlemen, to make the point that it is, these things can make sense, and it is possible for, and I will probably address some of the questions now, not in the order that they've been asked. It is quite possible for the members of a customs union like SACU to negotiate new trade agreements with third parties. As a matter of fact, it is a definite policy of those members and of South Africa to negotiate trade policies with Brazil, with Mercosur, with India, with China, with the United States. Why? Because it makes sense. It brings down the tariffs so the members can benefit. Governments make the rules, but they don't trade. So it is obviously to the benefit of traders and consumers that the obstacles to the movement of goods and capital and so on will be built down. So that is why we have trade agreements. They make sense. Now, the question is, is there a danger that we will not synchronize our efforts? It is possible to synchronize these efforts by adhering to the basic rules of the WTO. That is now in the formal sense. So the members of SACU, yes, they can negotiate as a single entity with China, with India, or with the European Union. The difficulty with the EPA is, Madam Chair, that the membership of the SADC EPA does not coincide or does not overlap with the membership of SADC. It's only the SACU members and Mozambique and Angola, so it's more difficult to negotiate, but therefore the end product, the formal product under the SADC EPA will be an FTA, a free trade area. So it must then cover substantially all trade between the European Union on the one hand and the SADC EPA members on the other hand. So from a technical point of view, it's not, they're not really big legal challenges. They are on sound legal footing. The challenge lies in bringing those national sensitivities and priorities together so that we speak out of one mouth, so to speak, and to make offers, tariff offers to the other side while negotiating, which will be compatible with what they want. And it's really the challenge of the meeting of minds. At what point will you agree that you will bolt down the tariffs on substantially all trade to the satisfaction of both negotiating blocks so that you can sign the agreement? The difficulty doesn't lie in the legal and technical side. It lies in the interests that are involved. And the more international trade agreements you have, obviously, the more mechanisms you also need to make sure that you can comply with the different rules. Because if you then import a bicycle from Taiwan, and that the tariff on that bicycle is governed by the MFN tariff of the WTO, then there must be a column in your tariff book indicating that. If you are into a free trade area with SADC, then there must be a column in your tariff book for that. If you are in an EPA with the European Union, there must be a column for tariffs for that. So those are the consequential challenges. Are we getting there?
Hoping we'd have large enough ledgers for this, but go on.
Well, maybe we must use computers. But let me also say, ladies and gentlemen, that I am a great supporter and of the idea of liberalizing trade and getting the obstacles out of the way. And when I said earlier that there is a note of skepticism with respect to what I hear coming from the African platforms, it is not because I'm opposed to those ideas. It's because of the level of ambition, which seems to me to be unrealistically high at that moment. You need patience when you do these things. Ladies and gentlemen, just look at how big our continent is, how widely diversified we are, from very poor to quite sophisticated. To bring all of the continent under one legal umbrella, forget about all the squabbling about sovereignty that you were then here, but just to bring the rules, all the rules, to the same level and apply them equally effectively in all the member states. Just think of the challenges in terms of capacity. That is why, if I understand you correctly, Honourable Member, about the difference between political and economic, or political and technical integration, I also share the view that we have to start patiently.
from the bottom and building it up. Because this is not a top-down exercise. And don't ignore the peoples living in those countries. They have to be taken along with this. And we can learn some important lessons from experience, for example, in the EAC, the East African Community, where for a long time, those three countries, and now there are more because Burundi and Rwanda have joined, but there was a lot of resentment in for example, Tanzania against Kenyan producers and exporters. So this thing about transparency is very important, and it's also important bringing the population with you and the traders and the private sector. And to some extent, a parliament is a very important institution in fulfilling that participatory and supervisory function. Now, there was a question about what is the future of bilateral agreements. Now, we in South Africa, as Professor McCarthy explained, we are in SACU, and SACU has a common external tariff. All of us are bound by that tariff. Now, South Africa is the big economy, not only in SACU, but in the whole region. So when industrial policy is developed, then the tariff will be used, as he has explained, as part of the mechanisms for giving effect to your own industrial and trade policy. From a technical point of view, as I've said, as long as you keep in mind what your obligations are in terms of your membership of existing organizations, it is not too difficult to work these things out. But then your subsequent information in your implementation of those rules must be available. There must be certainty as to where I can find the information about the applicable tariff. That must be there. So negotiating new trade agreements become quite difficult because you, not because of the law so much, but because of your interests and the destination of your exports and where your policies want to take you. So the debate about policy and leadership and regional development must be there. Is there a time frame for tripartite negotiations? They kicked off at quite a pace in 2008 and last year and the year before. There was a task team preparing documents. And where we stand now is we've got 13 annexes and a big agreement. So the documentation is there, but that documentation was prepared by a specialized task team representing the three structures, the three organizations, SADC, COMESA, and the EAC. What they will do from now on forward in concluding this, I don't know. There are some political noises coming from some of the member states, the 26, saying, well, we want to conclude it by the end of the year. There are others who say, no, it will take a lot longer. But technically, this thing will form an FTA, a free trade area, which will have to comply with WTO rules. Let's see. The real negotiations will only start now. The common currency has been mentioned a couple of times. Now, ladies and gentlemen, a common currency, as they have it in Europe, well, let's take the United States. The United States has a single currency because it's one single state. It's a big one. It's a federation, but only the United States is a subject of international law. So they all use the greenback there. So that's easy to understand, just as we in South Africa have only one currency. When you move up the road, up the ladder of integration, and you go beyond the ideas of only integrating trade issues, then you start talking about competition, you're talking about tax, you're talking about financial and fiscal matters. And the European Union is the most advanced form of regional integration in the world, in history. And it's quite amazing that 27 countries can actually cooperate on that on a high level. And one of the reasons why that is so has to do with their history after the Second World War, and because their policy is to give massive and very detailed powers to the Commission in Brussels. Certain areas are out of the control of the member states completely. Trade policy, competition, national governments don't have anything to say about that anymore. Now, that is really now a very important step where the members are prepared to transfer big chunks of sovereignty to a supranational body. And it works for them for particular reasons. Not all the EU members are party to the euro currency arrangement. That's an extra arrangement. That is an extra. I just want to make this point. This type of currency cooperation, financial and fiscal cooperation, is an additional thing. We are not really there in Africa. We haven't got any examples of that. I know noises are being made about this, and some of them have been made by Colonel Gaddafi, I assume, but let's bring down our level of ambition and realistic discourse to what is achievable at this moment. I would like to in 10 years' time from now, to discuss the African dollar with you, not now. I think I have addressed them. What did I forget?
No, I was asking about the regional policy that you fired a question, and it was quite interesting to me to know from your own point of view. Do we have it?
Does this country have a regional policy?
No. This country and the region, SACU as a whole, which is supposed to be...
Well, we have a debate about these matters, but we will first have to agree amongst ourselves when is a debate amounting to a regional policy. And the debate in my book is not a regional policy. A regional policy is where certain resources and political commitment are attached to a deliberate effort to make things happen and to change things. So this is a long debate for another day, but we are not there yet. And one of the reasons why we are not there yet is because we haven't got fora, we haven't got platforms geared towards that sort of debate. Maybe the summit in SACU will be such a platform. But then on the other hand, we have a summit in SADC. And you can better than I judge whether SADC effectively has a regional policy with respect to trade promotion and peace and democracy. The evidence doesn't seem to give a lot of support to that. Trudy has reminded me that I've forgotten to say something about the customs union. What was that, Trudy?
Membership of two customs unions.
What about it?
I think we sometimes hear a perception that the WTO prevents a country from belonging to two customs unions. That's not true. It's purely coming back to the definition of a customs union. A customs union means that the member states charge the same tariff at the borders, no matter which border it is. And if we're all charging the same tariff, you cannot charge two the same tariffs. So it's just as per the definition of a customs union that a country cannot belong to two customs unions. By contrast, a country can belong to any number of free trade areas because you as a member state maintain your trade policy space. Your tariff to external countries remains your policy decision. So you can conclude free trade areas with any number of countries. And I think that's quite important. Also in terms of the move from a free trade area to a customs union, because you do give up the trade policy space. You now have to do what all the other customs union members do. You can't change that external tariff. I think that's quite important in terms of the level of ambition of African integration schemes. And this is where, for example, we found within SADC, although politically we had committed to establishing a customs union by 2010, it simply was not feasible in that time frame. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hasenberg. Yes, you certainly are, I think, the face of Trolic, yes. Sorry about that. But Professor Erasmus, I know all of us would love to have had more time. But I think we do have an approach in the Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry and all our sister portfolios in Parliament, and that is we don't complete something. You can't. You know, this will be the beginning. It becomes an ongoing and open exercise, I believe, of engagement, of sharing, of learning. The learning process itself never stops. So we do hope that having had this opportunity, which took us a long time, it took us a year to find the space, we will, from time to time, even if it is only an hour and a half, bring you back on board just to share with us latest developments. So this is the beginning of that process and our partnership and relationship with yourself. So on behalf of all those who attended this workshop, a very, very big thank you. We do appreciate your time, your efforts, and your capacity to share your experience and information with us. Thank you all very, very much indeed. Members, for ourselves, that is the members of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, it's just a reminder about our program for Friday, which is a very, very important part of our program. I'm aware of a public holiday on Monday, so it's not a lack of awareness. But I do think we have to honour our commitments, please. And the Minister will be here, I understand, will he, or the Director General, to share that with us. It's a very, very important part of the process, Honourable Members. So please retain and maintain your dedication to your work. Your own electorate and constituency is depending on you. Thank you. Till Friday morning, half past 8 to 9 o'clock.